This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Art is often used to memorialize people and events. Sometimes the work is a celebration. Other times it's a way for the artist to represent grief and trauma. A conference this weekend at UNC Chapel Hill explores the role of art, particularly music, in remembrance. The conference is called Performing Commemoration, Musical Reenactment and the Politics of Trauma. Joining me now is Stefan Litvin. He's a music professor at UNC and a composer. He will perform this weekend as part of the conference. Welcome back, Stefan.
Great to be back.
Tell us more about what's behind this conference.
Well, it's a hinge on a performance of the so-called Defiant Requiem, which will be mounted in April, which is a performance of the Verdi Requiem, which supposedly was performed in the concentration camp Theresienstadt by prisoners there in 1943, I think, or 44. There's been a foundation that has sort of resurrected this event and has brought it to the stage in many places. So UNC is performing this, and we decided as a faculty that we should contextualize this performance. So talk about different types of trauma and how do you remember them, or how do you deal with the past?
Well, let's talk more about Verdi's work and its performance first in a concentration camp, and then how it becomes rendered again as a memorial. So tell us first about this performance at the camp and why this would come to anyone's attention.
Well, I think for the actual prisoners in Theresienstadt, the performance of the Verdi Requiem was a means to resist. That's why it's called the Defiant Requiem in this recreation. So for them, it was a matter of survival to actually perform a grand work of art under such horrible conditions. Today, to recreate that is an effort to commemorate this horrible past, but at the same time, it poses some questions. What are you commemorating? Are you commemorating a make-believe recreation of it, or is this something that we connect to in a manner that will bring us closer to what these people experienced? And I think that's actually a problematic part of this.
Well, let's talk more about that. So you have this performance at a concentration camp, then there's a story around it, and the story is told and retold about this defiant, this act of resistance under these extraordinary circumstances, and it becomes part of the public imagination.
We quickly get into the realm of sort of as we call it, the Holocaust industry. Mm. It's sort of the sense that we actually become voyeurs of a horrible part of history, and we know what the outcome will be, but we actually go back home and to our safe places. On the screens, whether it's Schindler's List or what have you, you see these poor victims dying, and you end up grieving with them continuing your life. So this is one narrative that has been established over the last 70 years of how to commemorate with this. In Germany, you'll have the ritual of commemorating Auschwitz Day, so forth. So it's always empathizing with the victims.
And then there's this artistic rendition, so the Defiant Requiem becomes another take. It becomes a performance in and of itself that's taken on the road, and it's got it's a video presentation, a multimedia presentation.
Right, it recontextualizes the Verdi Requiem in itself, but it also kind of uses the Holocaust ritual to present a new way of listening to this piece.
So there's a certain skepticism in what you're saying here, and yet I wonder, I mean, isn't this our only way in as those who could not possibly experience this? Aren't we required as citizens and as fellow humans to in one way or another make an attempt to enter into the grief of a fellow human being?
Well, that's a very important question you raise. I would counter it with another question. Is it even possible to empathize with victims of the Holocaust? Can we ever understand what they went through? And I think there have been other artists, authors, who have tried to give us a different perspective on these events. And for me, one of the most powerful examples of this counter literature was the Nobel laureate Imre Kertész, Hungarian Jew, who received the Nobel Prize for his novel Faithlessness in 2002. And with this novel, he found a new voice how to commemorate Auschwitz, the myth Auschwitz as he calls it, without empathy. Actually, he invites us to partake in the experience of a 15-year-old boy, which is he, of course, who was deported from Budapest, who looks at the camp from a very matter-of-fact attitude. There is no emotion in it. It's just, you know, it's a normal place for him because, you know, he doesn't expect anything bad. But then he sees bad things happening. But he says, well, this is part of the logical totalitarian system. You shouldn't be surprised that people die. And then he says, you know, Auschwitz is even a place where you can be bored under certain circumstances. So this is a very jarring approach to this topic that we are not used to because we've been sort of accustomed to through the Hollywood industry to grieve with the victims. Here, this victim isn't even grieving. He's not concerned. Yeah. That makes it all the worse for us as the spectator.
And sort of how we respond to the book, and in some ways he's saying, you know, I'm not really inviting your tears.
Yes,
know,
exactly. Right? I don't want your tears. Yeah. In fact, I want you to understand that unless you were a member of the camp prisoners, you will never comprehend what we went through.
And this is inspired in an original composition that you've written.
Yes. What inspired me particularly was that Imre Kertész's book, Fatelessness, he spoke about the book as it being a 12-tone novel. For him, the lack of a fundamental key, in tonality we always have a fundamental key, so if we have a piece in C major, C is the fundamental key for it. The lack of a fundamental key in atonal music is the lack of a moral compass. And with a totalitarian society, that moral compass was lost. And the 12-tone method, which was developed by Schoenberg, for Kertész, becomes a metaphor for the totalitarian system. All pitches behave according to the system and not according to the musician's or the composer's will. That's why the book is called Fatelessness, and fatelessness means the absence of tragedy, the absence of a human destiny. Once in the camp, you are just a puppet of that concentration camp system, which is guided by an overruling system.
But there is a logic. I mean, there's even a logic that the novelist discovers, although it's one that we might not that we might find jarring, since we want to have an emotional response based on our own moral guidance and our own compass. But there is a compass in that camp, simply one that we don't recognize or perhaps wouldn't want to embrace.
Yeah, I mean, in the key scene that I set to music from this novel, there's a journalist who, you know, when the boy comes out of concentration camp after the war ends, asks him, well, you know, don't you want to tell me about your experiences? And he says, well, what do you want to know? And he says, well, you know, tell me about the hell of the concentration camp. And he says, well, I can't tell you about hell because I've never been there, but I've been in a concentration camp, and that's a place where, you know, you can be bored under certain circumstances. And he says, well, mustn't we imagine the camp as a hell? And he says, well, you can imagine it whatever way you like. But, you know, for me, in fact, I can't imagine hell because that's a place that has no time. Whereas in camp, there is time that you have to survive. You have to survive 12 years, perhaps, each year in months, in weeks, in days, in hours, in minutes and seconds. And every moment you have to survive. And then the journalist says, well, that's almost impossible to imagine. And so the boy says, well, yeah, I guess that's why people call it hell.
And But Not Hell is the name of your composition. I'd like to hear a little piece of that right now. There's a very short clip of But Not Hell by Stefan Litvin, who is my guest today, also a UNC music professor. He's going to be performing this weekend as part of a conference at UNC Chapel Hill. It's called Performing Commemoration. So what do you do then as a composer who's trying to render in some ways this message of the inability to connect?
Yeah, well, this particular segment that you just played is one part of the piece which represents sort of this emotional identification, the quest for emotional identification. It's the, you know, the agitated manner of trying to understand what happened. And in another part that we won't hear probably, the piece behaves very differently musically. It's very matter of fact. Mm. It's very childlike. And so this dichotomy between the gesture of the journalist who's asking these questions, well-meant questions, and the constant denial of the boys saying, well, you know, I'm not going to give you what you're expecting. This becomes the musical form in the piece. And I think in the end, you realize there is no path into understanding.
How do you approach this as an artist? Is this an intellectual exercise? Do you try to feel, or do you try not to feel? Because I think you talked about the novelist himself.
Yes.
Working diligently to expunge.
Yes, he told me that he actually reworked the novel 50 times until he had exercised all feeling from it. So, you know, the fact that it is not biographical makes it biographical. That's the paradox in this novel. And I think what I tried to do in the piece is to capture that dichotomy of the two voices, of the two characters, allowing the novel to lead me. So for me, it was actually a way into experiencing a different perspective to deal with the Holocaust. Myself, coming from a family of Holocaust survivors, I had fed into, you know, believed in the former ritual of memory, you know, emotional depth, and this was a new insight for me.
Well, let me ask you another question. I want to follow up on that, and then perhaps move into a different direction. But what do you do as the composer? What do we do as listeners? To what extent is it important for us to know the story behind your work to understand what it is you're trying to convey?
Well, I think it's important in order to contextualize that you know what the Shoah is about. But I think knowing what the Shoah is about is already a problematic statement. Mm-hmm. How can we know? There have been millions of individual fates and millions that we'll never be able to speak about it. I mean, there's even that school of thought that says even the survivors cannot bear witness to those who perished. So what does it mean to know the context? I think it becomes a parable. It becomes a parable for trauma on a much more general level. Can we help communicate a traumatic event in any way that will give us insight and help us prevent it from happening again?
So along those lines, I'll ask a variation on a question I asked earlier, which is, aren't we responsible for responding emotionally, even if we to some degree trivialize, if we to some degree reduce and then start repeating the Hollywood myth? Aren't we responsible for having an emotional response to this so that we don't repeat it? We're so horrified by it, even if we're misguided, at least we're warned never to do this again.
Well, in principle, yes, but I would be a little more provocative in the sense that, you know, appropriating the victims and appropriating their experience can lead to new crimes. I mean, we see it, and I'll say this in a provocative sense. I mean, we see it in the state of Israel and the way they deal with the Palestinians. I mean, Palestinians have become the second victims of the Holocaust because certain parts of the Israeli society have appropriated the Holocaust as their right to victimize others, because they say we will never be victims again. So this is a hugely problematic area, and I think what Curtis does with the novel is he shows us this is not an exceptional case of history. This is part of a totalitarian system, and we should beware of any authoritarianism or totalitarianism.
Including the appropriation of grief.
Yes, indeed.
So you're also going to play a piece this Friday as part of this conference by Claude Debussy from 1914, mm-hmm. that explores the trauma of World War I. I want to hear a little clip, and then maybe you can tell us how this plays a part.
Thank you.
was a short clip from Claude Debussy's 1914 Berceuse Heroique. And my guest is Professor, UNC Music Professor Stefan Litvin, who will perform this weekend as part of a conference, UNC Chapel Hill Performing Commemoration. So tell us about that piece.
This piece was a spontaneous reaction by Claude Debussy to write a work in homage to the Belgian nation that had been overrun by the German army in World War I. If you recall, there had been already, before World War I, a so-called Schlieffen Plan. This was a general of the German army, how to attack France from the north because the western border was secured. So it involved going through Belgium, and Belgium at the time was a neutral state. So Albert the First didn't allow the Germans to go through Belgium to attack France, and Germany did it anyway. So it attacked Belgium, and this is when Debussy responded. And what we just heard is a quotation of the Belgian anthem in this berceuse. So it's a very somber, empathic work, but obviously we're talking a period before the Holocaust.
Right, right. And it's interesting period, too, because you have people, modernist writers, who some would say, like Kafka perhaps, were anticipating the Holocaust in their kind of modernist form of breaking down the form. And others who were certainly stuck in or sort of looking back to this romantic period where they're trying to engage and create shared identities,
yes,
right? And so we're at this crossroads.
No, I think that's clear. I mean, Debussy was a modernist composer in a certain way, but he held on to tonality, which is what, you know, in our prior conversation, we talked about that moral compass. It's what we have in common. There is no commonality after Auschwitz. And actually, just to remind you also of one of the most important quotations after the Holocaust, Adorno said, after Auschwitz, writing a poem is barbaric. So it's the inversion of our belief system.
But we still do it. I want to play a short piece that will also be featured this weekend. Alan Anderson's going to perform a new piece about the Trail of Tears. It's called Fire, and here's a short clip. Very short clip from Fire by Alan Anderson, talking with professor and composer Stefan Litvin, who will be part of a conference at UNC Chapel Hill called Performing Commemoration. Sorry for the short clips. If you want to hear more, you'll have to attend the conference, but tell us about the relevance of that piece.
Well, this is about the Trail of Tears. This is my very wonderful colleague, Alan Anderson, composer. He has written a larger work on the Trail of Tears, which is the four death marches of Native Americans into the reservations they were given. This is one part of various movements, and it's based, as I believe, on a poem by Gladys Cardiff, who herself is Cherokee.
Well, we'll find out more certainly if we attend the conference. But again, I've got about 30 seconds left. I want to ask you quickly. This is a representation of a horrific event. So aren't we kind of
trailing that same mitigated territory? Through literature, through poetry. It's not actual testimony.
Stefan Litvin, composer, music professor at UNC Chapel Hill, is going to be performing as part of a conference this Friday through Sunday at UNC Chapel Hill called Performing Commemoration, Musical Reenactments of Political Trauma. As always, Stefan, what a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Just ahead, we're going to talk with a political science professor about whether Southern identity still matters. Stay tuned.